يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to our Middle East Analysis podcast. Now, this is the first one since the Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI's visit to Lebanon, and that's a subject that we're going to be touching upon in a further podcast. But today's podcast obviously focuses in on the MENA region, the Middle East North Africa region, and for that, as usual, and a great pleasure it is too, I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, the Bishop's consultant on that very region. Harry, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, James. Nice seeing you. Although it's all wet and miserable outside, it's quite cozy once again in your little studio.
Well, of that, I'm glad. I'm very, very glad. Now, do you know, I'm going to start in a rather weird way, to be honest, this morning.
Because go ahead.
To mark the Holy Father being in Lebanon, found myself quite late at night after work in M&S thinking, oh, you know, wouldn't mind sharing a bottle of wine with my wife. And so I looked at it and I found a number of Lebanese reds and thought, ah, well, wouldn't it only be just and right and proper for me to have one of those Lebanese reds tonight to mark the Holy Father being there? And I tell you what, it was a mixture of four grapes. The name completely escapes me, but I should find out. I felt like I'd been drugged. It was the strongest wine I have ever had. I looked straight to bed, Harry. So I don't know what you know about Lebanese wines, but
they're
quite lethal.
Well, I'll tell you what I know about Lebanese wine. Lebanese wine is very, very good. And particularly Lebanese red wine.
Mm.
And every time I go to Lebanon, I always make it a point to go to a couple of my favorite wine shops where I get a bottle of Lebanese wine and enjoy it with friends. It is really delightful.
I tell you what, though, drink it sitting down. That's my one piece of advice.
And you know, it's interesting, but it also depends on the choice of the wine, James, and it also depends on where you buy it, because if you get it in this country, it is hugely expensive. And it wouldn't necessarily be the best kind of wine they have, unless you know what you're looking for. If you go to a place like Inoteca, which is one of the good wine shops in Beirut, you would find some very good wine at fairly palatable prices insofar as our prices go in this country.
Well, from the palatable to the slightly
unpalatable.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those that really are wondering where we're going with this podcast, let's spell it out. There have obviously been huge protests across the region about this, and I call it a so-called film because I have seen a good 13, 14 minutes of it on YouTube, and, less said about it, the better in some ways. But it is The Innocence of Muslims, so it's called. It's blatantly an edited, re-edited, triple-edited and four times dubbed production, this one. But it has caused outrage as to the treatment of the Prophet Muhammad, of course, Harry. And I'd like you just to set the context for us. I mean, this has been rumbling on now for over a week. The protests aren't really abating that much, are they?
The protests, James, will eventually abate. This is the nature of protests of this nature. We've seen it time and time again. We've seen it with other incidents that Muslims in the street have considered it an insult to Islam or an insult to the Prophet Muhammad and have gone out in the streets in their hundreds or thousands in order to protest against what they perceive as an insult against their religion and their basic core values. But this one has also, to some extent, provoked the same kind of reaction. Like you, I saw the trailer on YouTube of Innocence of Muslims, and I find it tawdry, I find it simplistic, and I really find it gross. And in that sense, I find it totally irrelevant to the whole discourse. But in a region where religious sensitivities can easily be polarized, or in a region where people can polarize other people's religious sensitivities, then this created this furore across the whole Arab and Muslim worlds, from Iran, Libya, Egypt, to Morocco, to Pakistan, to many other countries. And of course, it led to the very unfortunate and very sad death, amongst others, of the American ambassador in Libya, J. Christopher Stevens, who was, in my opinion, one of the best friends that Libya could have at the moment. He had been with the Libyan rebels in Benghazi when NATO was trying to get rid of Gaddafi and neutralize his forces. He then established himself at the embassy in Tripoli. He devoted his time trying to understand Libya and make Libyans understood outside, particularly in the U.S. administration. So to have some buddy like him, of his caliber but with his goodwill, killed, shows to me also the sad irrelevance of unnecessary violence.
Well, I can agree more with that point. And, you know, if you look at what happened in the UK with something like Jerry Springer, the opera.
Oh, yes.
Criticising Christ, obviously, in quite strong terms. There have been various exhibitions over the years that Christians have taken great exception to in their portrayal of Christ. But we've not really seen deaths. We've not seen levels of violence on the streets. Now, the question I suppose I'm asking is, surely this is a disproportionate response to something that admittedly is very offensive.
It is, actually, and you are absolutely right. We have had the Jerry Springer show. We have had the Piss Christ, which was the cross in an artist's urine in an exhibition. For the life of me, I can't understand where the art is in that. We've had other examples as well. And of course, the Christians have taken offense, but they have even demonstrated. They have even protested. They've objected to the desecration of their religious values. However, it hasn't gone to this extent of the violence that we have seen time and time again in some of those Arab and Muslim countries, so much so that I'm sure you know this because you're much more a Twitter aficionado than I can ever claim to be. There is now a hashtag with Muslim rage to it, which shows basically about this whole Muslim world being enraged by the insult they perceive to their prophet and therefore to their religion. To that, I would like to put two qualifiers, if I may, James. The first qualifier is that if we look at those demonstrations, whether those that took place in Libya initially, which then mushroomed across the Arab and Muslim worlds, it's only by a few hundred or at best a few thousand very vocal, very aggressive people going out. Those who go out spontaneously and those who went out in a pre-planned way, protesting. So, one, I would wish, and perhaps now is not the time, to question about the nature, origin, and source of those demonstrations. But I would also say if there were a few hundred or a few thousand here, there, and everywhere in front of an embassy in Iran, in front of a mission in Pakistan, what have you, what about the overwhelming majority of Muslims who have themselves not only kept quiet, kept mum, even been embarrassed, and who have somehow very outspokenly said that what is happening in the name of Islam is wrong and that this violence is inappropriate for the event. So let's put this in context. A few hundred, a few thousand kicked up a huge fuss. We got hashtagged Muslim rage. We've got an ambassador dead, other people who've died across the region. But the overwhelming majority of Muslims and certainly non-Muslims decry this kind of violence. That's one thing that I would beg our listeners to think of. The other thing I would say is that what exactly are Muslims demonstrating against? Those who are demonstrating, those who are out in the streets shouting, carrying slogans. Are they demonstrating against this particular event? Are they demonstrating about far wider issues? Are they demonstrating against the West in general? And are they aware of the fact that this is not necessarily the way that the Prophet Muhammad would have dealt with insults to the Muslim faith? And therefore, what exactly is the reason for this? And let us not forget that there is the Prophet, but above the Prophet, there is also the Almighty. There is also God. And therefore, we have to put this in its proper context. And I'm going to, if I may, James, just give you one simple example of how this doesn't work necessarily well with every Muslim. There is an organization in the States, actually, if I'm not mistaken, it's based in California, called Muslims for Progressive Values. And they came out with a press release, like many other Muslim organizations did, or individuals, saying this is wrong, it shouldn't happen. But one of the things they reminded their Muslim constituency is that the Prophet Muhammad himself faced direct persecution sometimes during his life, but never responded with violence. And this reminded me of a very well-known narration. There was a woman in Mecca who would constantly insult the Prophet Muhammad. She would throw or dump refuse at his door. She would basically throw thorns or lay thorns in his path. And sometimes it's even recorded that she poured dung on his head while he was praying. Now, you would expect the Prophet himself to mobilize his outrage, and all his followers would go and kill this woman or imprison this woman or do whatever at that time, which goes back 1,400 years. No, what did he do? He suddenly one day realized that she was not around, basically pestering him. And instead of responding with anger to what she was doing, to the violence, he asked, "Where is she? Is she okay?" And he went and visited her when he found out that she was sick. This is another face of Islam that we in the West sometimes do not know. And this is the face of Islam that those people out in the streets who are shouting about whatever slogan they're shouting about completely miss the point and ignore.
Well, that is a very good point. And that therein is the problem, isn't it? Because obviously news outlets are going to cover the protests. If it is newsworthy, it will be covered. So the motivations that you're talking about, or the possible motivations behind protesting to this level in this way, I don't think they become immaterial. But if you're just a viewer, a listener at home, you're going to think this is a general protest against the decadence of the West, or a general protest against the foreign policy of America, or a general protest against the value system outside the Islamic world. That's what you would probably think, unless you knew better. So,
absolutely.
So that's the problem I have. And to echo your point, when I was in Tehran in 2006, after a similar sort of insult, if you like, in the art and culture world, the Jelens Posten, the Danish cartoons of the Prophet. On the one hand, probably not a mile or two away from where I was staying, there were burnings of effigies, there were very strong protests. Mm-hmm. And yet, when I walked the streets, I didn't feel threatened. I was treated exceptionally well, actually. Mm-hmm. So, you know, contrary to the thought that it's all anti-Western and, you know, the people don't like us because we're different and vice versa, that's absolute nonsense and something I didn't encounter even at a flashpoint time like that.
I think, James, you're absolutely right. And what we need to do, really, I believe, is to go a little bit beyond the instance of those violent acts and ask ourselves why is this happening? And whether it's in the hundreds or in the thousands or in the tens of thousands, it is quite clear. President Morsi of Egypt basically said it, that there is a certain hatred of the West within the Muslim world. The question is, why? Is it because of the Danish cartoons? Is it because of the cartoons in the Charlie Hebdo, a French magazine, only last week? Is it because of all those exhibitions or statements or books or cartoons that are coming out? Or is there more to it? I would tend to think that there is far more to it. And what I found very interesting, James, is that when the Libyan issue happened and the unfortunate death of a wonderful ambassador and his companions, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton came up with a statement saying, but we don't understand why this is happening. We helped the Libyans overthrow Colonel Gaddafi about a year plus ago. Are they repaying our kindness in this way? Then, of course, the media, as you said, leapt in. Politicians who aren't worth much started giving their 2 pence worth of opinion that, oh yes, look what happens, the ungrateful Arabs and Muslims, we are helping them in the Arab Spring, so-called, the uprisings across the whole region, and this is how they repay our kindness. We did it with them in Libya, we helped them in Egypt, we helped them in Tunisia, now we're trying to help them in Syria. Maybe the Arab Spring is not such a good thing. Maybe America and the West should rethink its policies toward issues of freedom, democracy, dignity in the MENA region. And I thought to myself, have we reached this stage of short-sightedness in our political understanding of the region, that we take one incident and we make a whole concept of it? So let me remind you of a few things that I believe are happening at the moment as we see this anger, or as President Morsi of Egypt called it, the hatred. It goes both ways. It's both issues to do with the region itself and the people of the region. It's got to do with the West, and it's got to do with the dynamics within Islam. So let me very briefly cover those 3 areas. 1, the West. Yes, we helped, albeit reluctantly, with the so-called Arab Spring. That is a brownie point we scored with many liberal people in the Arab and Muslim worlds. But counter to that, what can I think of? I can think of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and our unflinching, unstinting support for Israel at the expense of the self-determination of the Palestinian people. I can think of all the stories that came out of Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. I could think of the war in Iraq. I could think of the ill treatment and the stories coming out of Guantanamo. All these things polarize the Muslim world, that the West is basically against them. Now, this is a short podcast. It is neither my place nor your place to analyze whether they are right or wrong in thinking the way they do. But those are some issues that impact the region. Even the Arab Spring and the reluctance of the West to help, particularly in Syria these days, is also another example of why there is anger. Now, this is on the level of the West. There is a whole host of things, and I am in the process of trying to put together an opinion piece, hopefully that I would share with our listeners on some of those issues. But then you look at the other side. You ask yourself, why are they angry, the Arabs and the Muslims, within their own countries? They're angry, they're riven by this pent-up anger because of the lack of jobs, because of the repression, because of the economic stagnation, because of the totalitarian and authoritarian regimes that have snuffed them, that have actually disallowed them from breathing and robbed them of all their rights. All this builds up, and every now and then, like a pressure cooker, you release the valve a little bit and you see this incredible jet of steam coming out. That is also part of the reason why this anger is happening. And finally, let us also not forget, and Egypt is the classic example post Hosni Mubarak. We've got a new president who's part of the Muslim Brotherhood. He used to be the head of the Muslim Brotherhood at one stage. He is now president. As president, he is realizing that what he could say or do as a Muslim Brotherhood leader is not the same as what he can say or do as president of a wonderful country, Egypt, in the heartland of the MENA region. Therefore, what is also happening, in my opinion, now, and it's extremely interesting for people to watch if they take 2 minutes to scratch the surface, is that the Muslim Brotherhood and the more Salafist, radical Muslims within the whole region, including in Egypt, are now in competition. This is what's happening. There is a rivalry between the Salafists on the one hand and the Muslim Brotherhood on the other on who is more Muslim and who has better Islamic credentials. Put all these together, no wonder Twitter has hashtagged it as the Muslim rage.
Possibly I'm not going to ask you this because I was then going to move on to something that I think, in light of what you've just said, might seem a little superficial. I was going to make the perhaps fairly obvious point. Well, what about freedom of expression? You know, Jerry Springer, the opera, if you want to look at a Christian context, the Jelenspostan cartoons, this ridiculous film, Innocence of Muslims. Yes, I find each one of those across the religions insulting, and I can see why people would feel insulted. But really, you know, aren't we entitled to express ourselves? And even if it does go overboard, obviously if people are dying, that's completely different. But there should be some form of sort of critical debate, shouldn't there?
Absolutely, James. And the whole issue that is now being talked about all the way from Egypt to Iran to elsewhere is, do we manage to legislate against freedom of expression? Do we come up with some sort of an international law on blasphemy that would actually apply across the board when events of this nature or issues of this nature come to the fore? I know that the American administration, and particularly President Obama in an election year, apologize time and time again. I mean, it seems to me that we are in an era of politics where apology is the easiest word. Elton John said in one of his favorite songs, sorry seems to be the hardest word. In politics, sorry seems to be the easiest word. Hillary Clinton apologizes, President Obama apologizes, Nick Clegg apologizes over his manifesto. Everybody apologizes. But because America said it's against the First Amendment, a constitutional right, Americans cannot interfere with this tawdry, stupid trailer that has been produced. And incidentally, this film achieved its purpose. Its purpose was not to clarify to the non-Muslim world about how bad Islam is, but to provoke Muslims to react in the exact way they reacted in order that they themselves show the ugly face of Islam as a religion to the outside world. And some of those people out there in the streets shouting their lungs out without having a clue what they're shouting about, these are the people who are giving Islam as bad a name as some Westerners and neocons and radical Christians who think that there is absolutely nothing right in Islam, and shame upon them too. But when it comes to freedom of expression, I'll tell you what, I'm going to, what's the expression in English? Nail my mast or make my beliefs very clear. There's an expression we have in English.
It's kind of like nail your colors to the flagpole.
That's it. Nail my colors to the mast. That's exactly it. I support freedom of expression. I wouldn't want freedom of expression to be in any way diluted, because I am proud that after we in the West have had all our revolutions, all our bad years, all our violence, all our killings, and all our dark ages, we actually now, to some extent, I must add, stand up for the freedom of expression. And I paraphrase to you what Voltaire said in France when he said, I would disagree with what you say, but I would die for your right to say it. And in a sense, what I would say, that if my right to say what I want to say is not defended, then automatically I'm depriving you of your right to say what you think is right. And that's a very slippery slope, because we're going toward basically censorship in a major way. And I think, yes, what is necessary, and we see this all the time in our country here in the UK and across Europe, look at the photos of the Duchess of Cambridge with the topless photos. I mean, there was self-censorship exercised by the most lurid tabloids in this country. However, in France and in Italy and elsewhere, they did publish those. Although, interestingly enough, in this country, what applies is self-censorship. What applies in Italy and France is legislation that criminalizes the publication of such photos. We saw it. The palace took them to court and they won. But it's not a question of imposing by fine or legislation, you're right. It is by making people understand through education and awareness that this is an inherent right. When you have that right, then you know how to use it and respect it. It is only when you are deprived of it that you start going apoplectic when somebody else uses it.
Well, that's very true. And you see, the other issue for me when it comes to legislation is that, now, I don't really want to look to Pakistan's blasphemy laws, but then you get down to legal definitions. What is blasphemy? You know, if me practicing as a Catholic is considered blasphemous because I'm not practicing as a Muslim, then you've got a problem, haven't you? So legislation is all about definition as well. So it's a difficult thing, I think.
I would absolutely agree with you. And unfortunately, he's dead now. But one, in my opinion, one of the most prolific thinkers, theologians within the Muslim world was somebody, an Egyptian, called Nasser Hamid Abu Zayd. He's dead. He died a couple of years ago. But he was a person who spoke constantly about the right of every human being on the face of this earth, including Muslims, to basically have the right to express their opinions. You object, object. You protest, protest. But you don't go about killing people. And interestingly enough, what has happened, in my opinion, within Islam, and again, the podcast is not the place to do it, so it's just a little thought for people to take forward if they so wish, is that we had the whole era of what was known under Turkish occupation, those four dark centuries, of caliphates. The caliphates disappeared with the disappearance of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. What we're seeing now is that some people who yearn for those days are actually trying to impose a rigorous Sharia-led society that would be a Mark II of what was a caliphate then. In other words, we are in the process now, and we Christians have faced this process with our Reformation, with the different councils that we have had across the decades and centuries. What we are now facing is within Islam is a choice between reform on the one hand and return to rigorous Islamic imposition of laws on the other. And I believe, although I would disagree with the way that Salman Rushdie came up with his satanic verses, but I think Salman Rushdie, who is now also in the news because he's published his new book, Anton Joseph, I think the question that needs to be asked is, do I have the right to say what I say, and do you have the right to object to it?
Now, I'll tell you what, we've definitely given you your freedom of expression, Harry. We're I got all het up a bit, didn't I?
No, well, it's interesting stuff. Usually I'm a little bit more detached.
No, I've enjoyed it. It's been very interesting. But we are forging up to the 28-minute mark, which means it is time for, well, I don't know what I'd term this as, things to think about over the coming weeks. Give us a couple of things. Keep it brief. In fact, imagine you've got that countdown clock on that we all know and love. From that wonderful show. The clock's on. Give us some things to ponder over the next couple of weeks.
You're not worried about giving me this moment, are you?
Look, we've just talked about a highly controversial film. If I'm worried about that, we're in trouble.
Good for you. Let me just share with our listeners two things that concern me and that I'm following and that maybe in future MENA podcasts we'll probably cover. One is the Palestinian Authority is now going to the United Nations General Assembly in order to shift the recognition of Palestine into a non-state within the General Assembly. And this is a very interesting issue because it has not only political but legal ramifications insofar as it then legally defines occupation in the Palestinian territories. So maybe we could think and follow up what's going to happen at the United Nations General Assembly, because this is now the season for all those leaders to come and give their famous speeches. The other thing I would say is Syria. Syria, I look at Syria with a very heavy heart. I cannot believe that everybody is standing by playing politics when 30,000 people have been killed, when the country is basically a war zone with planes, helicopters, tanks, etc. But one thing I would also say, in order to be fair, is I'm also concerned about the foreign elements, the foreign jihadis, as they're being called for ease of reference, from Afghanistan, from Yemen, from other countries, who are coming into Syria to fight against the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Also, let me throw in there are rumors that Iran is using Iraqi airspace and Iraqi landmass in order to take tons of military supplies to the regime to unleash against the rebels or the so-called Free Syrian Army. So basically, Syria really, really makes me sad as to what is happening. A wonderful people, James. I know them. You might not have had the opportunity to see them, and it's sad. And let me finish on a serious, funny note. and that is our own famous chief whip, Andrew Mitchell, who suddenly called a police officer doing his job a pleb. Or did he call him a pleb? If he did, it's very interesting because it takes me back to the years when I was doing Roman law at law school, and a pleb was a term used during the Roman Senate times. So where are we going with our society today is the question I leave, if allegedly that term was used and we are not yet sure whether it was or not.
That's a ginormous topic to open up after half an hour, I have to say.
I thought I would throw that local domestic challenge your way.
Well, absolutely. And I can only say to those listening that you can catch us on Twitter at CatholicEW for the Bishop's Conference stream and at Harry Hagopian, of course, for Harry's own Twitter feed. We'll obviously be picking up on the Holy Father's visit to Lebanon in more detail with Bishop Declan Lang.
I'm delighted to say that Bishop Declan Lang, who is the Chair of International Affairs at the Conference of Bishops and who knows Lebanon and of course knows the Holy Father, will hopefully join me in the podcast as we assess the visit. We did a foretaste of the visit. Now, hopefully, James, with your help, we'll do an aftertaste.
Absolutely. Well, we still want your company on catholicnews.org.uk. That's it for Middle East Analysis, and as you've just heard, we'll be back very soon.